This is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome you to our Preparing for Board Certification in Advanced Diabetes Management. I really enjoy presenting this webinar because there's so much information out there about becoming a BCADM, but to kind of harness it into one presentation and really access the information takes a little time. So I put together this presentation so that within the hour you can get a good idea of what is included in the exam, what are the qualifications, and some strategies for success. I have taken the BCADM exam twice and I've renewed once, so I've done it for three cycles and I'm up for my next one. And so I've been a part of this program for a long time and I'm happy to share this information with you. So what we're going to talk about today are what are the qualifications to take the exam, how do you apply for it, what's in the exam, how to study for it. We're going to do some test taking tips and we'll do some practice questions, and then I provide resources for you also. So that's what we're going to do. But before I launch into the official presentation, I'd like to find out a little bit more about you all. And my first question is, what is your profession? And you can choose more than one. And so I only have five slots to put in professions. So I try to capture the most common professions, but some of you might fall under category E, other awesome healthcare professional not listed here. And many of you may be a healthcare professional with a CDE, so you can choose more than one. All right, thanks for voting, everyone. I appreciate it. These polls really help me because obviously I can't see you. I wish I could. So these polls really give me information about, you know, your response to these different questions and what your needs are. Okay, so 50% of you, I'm going to share this, are providers, 21% of you are registered dietitians, 14% are pharmacists, and in addition, 36 are one, you know, almost, you know, about 40% of you are CDEs. So that's a pretty common mix of people who attend this program, and certainly, as you know, to manage this epidemic of diabetes, we need a team. We need an interdisciplinary team. So the more, you know, diverse array of healthcare professionals we can enroll in this project to help people with diabetes, you know, keep healthy and then help our communities to prevent diabetes, it's really important. I want to ask you another question. I know some of you are just thinking about taking the BCADM, but what is your motivation for thinking about taking the BCADM or actually taking the BCADM? Is it required by your job, professional growth? You can choose more than one. Career advancement, more independent practice, or do you want your colleagues to really acknowledge your skill set? All right. Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share. So very few of you said it's required by job, so it seems like more of a professional growth. You know, most of you are saying, yeah, I really want to expand my knowledge. And I want to grow professionally. This is kind of a next logical step in advancing my knowledge and my career. And then 36% of you said more independent in practice, so you want to show your colleagues or your employer. This certification is showing that I have a specialized knowledge in not just diabetes education, but also management. And to acknowledge that specialized skill set. I think the great thing about the BCADM, to be honest, because I'm a CDE and a BCADM, is that a lot of times as a diabetes educator, I'm doing a lot of advanced level stuff and I'm not really, you know, getting credit for it. And I'm not saying that in a way like I need accolades for what I do, but it's not really known to the providers that I have a specialized, you know, management skills that I'm doing. But the BCADM says and verifies that, yes, I work at an advanced level. My next question is, when do you plan to take the BCADM exam? Is it December 2015, June 2016, sometime in 2016, and in the future? And I'm not really sure. I'm just checking it out. Okay. Thank you. All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. I'm going to take about 30 seconds on the poll so we can keep moving. So thanks for voting, everybody, and share this. So about a third of you are looking December 2015, right around the corner, during the holidays. What a great timing to provide an exam. I guess you can take the exam and then celebrate afterward. 35% of you June 2016, 18% maybe in the fall or, you know, the winter 2016. And then about 18% of you are in the future or not quite sure, just checking it out. Okay, thank you. That helps a lot. So here are the qualifications to take the BCADM exam. And all this information has been excerpted from the American Association of Diabetes Educators. They're the ones now conducting the exam and in charge of the exam. It's gone under a lot of different, you know, hands, and it's traded places over time, and the test has evolved. But currently, this was where the exam stands. And there's just one exam for everybody. But here's the eligibility criteria. You need to have at least your nursing degree, registered dietitian, a pharmacist, physician assistant, or a physician with an advanced degree. So for nurses, dietitians, and pharmacists, they need to have an advanced degree, and that includes physician's assistants. The physicians that qualify include MD or DO. So that's the licensure and advanced degree requirement, and then right under that is the experience. So this is a little bit different than the CDE exam because you need 500 clinical practice hours within 48 months. So 500 advanced practice hours 4 years before taking the exam. And it has to be clinical hours relevant to your licensure and after your advanced degree has been attained. And a lot of people say, what's the difference between CDE and BCADM? We're going to be noodling through that throughout this webinar. But it's a more advanced level of practice. If you look at this bottom box here, the advanced diabetes manager skillfully manages complex patient needs. And really, we do a lot with therapeutic problem solving, and that includes, you know, medication, labs, looking at comorbidities and doing diagnostic tests for comorbidities and assigning medications and prescriptions to treat those, and including nutrition therapy and activities. So we also counsel patients on lifestyle. That's an important part. We address psychosocial issues, and really important here, that last part of the sentence is we participate in research and mentoring. Advanced practice level says we take it up a notch. You know, we're going to be a leader in our field. We're going to do research. We're going to mentor. We're going to really provide information for our colleagues and for our students to provide really excellent diabetes education. So the question here is, why take this BCADM exam? And I think what we've talked about already is it validates our specialized knowledge and expertise. And it says here a really important word in the management of people with diabetes. So we certainly are considered diabetes managers, not just of the diabetes, but of the diabetes comorbidities associated with it. And the hope initially with the BCADM certification is that we would be able to work more independently and be reimbursed for advanced level of care. Well, that hasn't really worked out the way it was initially conceived. I mean, it can help move in that direction, hopefully in the future, but for most people with BCADMs, we still have to work with under, you know, our licensure and our guidelines and our state based on what our, you know, licensure is. So I'm an RN BCADM, but in California, I couldn't open my own clinic and start practicing independently. I still would have to be under the auspices of a provider. Role of BCADM, here it is again, skillfully manages complex patient needs and assists patients with therapeutic problem solving. So within our scope of practice, whatever your licensure is, the BCADM would help adjust medications, treat and monitor acute and chronic complications, counsel patients on lifestyle, look at psychosocial, and then we said this already, participate in research and mentoring. Now, here's a slide that kind of separates out. What's the difference? So CDE supports and educates people affected by prediabetes and diabetes to understand and self-manage their condition. We help develop individualized behavior and treatment goals to optimize health. The BCADM must have a master's degree. And again, it's the next level. We're going to manage not only diabetes, but the comorbidities. And certainly the BCADM recognizes that there's a lot more complexity in our decision making. So we have to have a lot more experience and knowledge accumulated to earn this certification. So I just want to kind of run you through my life and how I became involved with the BCADM. I first took the exam in 2001. I have here before children, so I could actually had time to study. And it was kind of an interesting exam. I had been working at Stanford Hospital doing the inpatient diabetes care, and I took the exam, and wow, it really opened my eyes to what I didn't know. Because I was so focused to acute care and inpatient, I had done outpatient also, but I hadn't really worked in a capacity where I would manage comorbidities and know all the medications for hypertension, hyperlipidemia, thyroid disease, and all the diagnostic testing. So I did pass the test, but it really opened my eyes to say there is so much to learn about diabetes. And I think, honestly, it really pushed me to the next level because I really understood what I didn't know. And I think that's what a good exam does. It helps you understand, hey, these are some areas you really can grow in. And so I think that was exciting for me. I was ready for it. And a lot of you, I'm sure, are ready for that too. Where is my next growth coming from? I'm ready for to take on a new challenge. So I created a critical assessment course as a result, and that now is on my online university. The critical assessment course looks at not only diabetes, but treating the comorbidities often associated with it and what labs we need to look for. I actually was a member of the ANCC to provide a review course for the BCADM, and I did that for a while till they moved the test over to AADE. I retook the exam in 2006. I did a lot better on my second go because I knew what to expect and I knew how to study for it. And then 2011, they stopped allowing us to take the exam. We had to renew by, as I put it here, completing a bunch of stuff, which I'll go over later. And then actually they reached out to me, AADE, to say, hey, can you help us write the new test questions for the BCADM since I've, you know, been doing this for so long? But I said, I just really can't because I don't want to have a conflict of interest because then I couldn't teach this course to all of you. I would have insider knowledge. So my current role, as many of you, I work in a hospital setting and I run the inpatient and the outpatient program. And I do this one day a week and the other 4 days a week I'm running my consulting business, Diabetes Education Services. So I do work as a consultant, that's my main job. But I am honored and privileged to work at a hospital one day a week and they hired me as a consultant 18 years ago to run their outpatient program and then I set up an inpatient program. And in this role as a diabetes program manager, I am wearing both my CDE hat and my BCADM hat, as many of us do. So my CDE, I meet with my patients, I'm helping them with behavior change, goals, lifestyle coaching, and then I'm also put my BCADM hat on and I'm helping them with medication management. They've got neuropathy. What medications are you on to treat that? Is it an adequate dose? And reaching out to the providers on different aspects of their diabetes condition and making suggestions. So I'm working as a consultant to providers and to my patients. And I'm also an advocate. I think that's a big part of BCADM. We are advocating constantly for our patients, but we're not just advocating for our individual patients. We're advocating for better care. We're looking at clinical outcomes. We're doing research. We're doing outcome measurements. And certainly at my hospital, we do, we're ADA recognized programs, so we measure our outcomes for our outpatient program, but I also am responsible, we set up a program to measure our inpatient outcomes. So every year we look at our blood sugars, and are they reaching targets as set by the ADA and the AACE? And if our blood sugars inpatient aren't reaching targets, we're going to make changes. There are policies and procedures to improve that. So that kind of, I hope, helps you see where both of these come in. And the BCADM certainly is going to be writing articles, participating in research, doing quality improvement. So it's a bigger, expansive role. Mm-hmm. Board certification, advanced diabetes management. This is from the website. The depth of knowledge and competence in advanced clinical practice and diabetes skills affords an increased complexity of decision making, which contributes to better patient care. That's a real nice summary. I like this by Ann Daly. She says, becoming a BCADM provides opportunities for healthcare professionals to expand their roles beyond traditional boundaries. And that's what we do. We're doing that anyway, so let's get credit for it. And to demonstrate their effectiveness in performing at an advanced level of practice. This is an old article, 2003, but this quote, I think, is really relevant to today. So what are the qualifications? We've gone over that clinical licensure plus advanced degree and 500 clinical practice hours in advanced diabetes management within 4 years prior to taking the exam. So here are some of your questions. For the 500 hours, what is considered advanced diabetes management? How do you document your hours? And as a CDE, how will this expand my role? And is the AADE version of the BCADM very much like the CDE exam? So what I like to do, just for a second, is talk about the second one, how to document your hours. All you need to do is get a notepad and just put down, you know, on there every week how many hours you provide advanced diabetes management and care. And then you just need to identify a supervisor, a boss, somebody who will verify that, yes, you have completed those hours. So that's that. And then as a CDE, how will this expand my role? I think I've kind of covered that. It just really acknowledges your level of advanced expertise in diabetes care and management. And is the BCADM exam very much like the CDE? Well, there are some overlaps. So if I was taking the CDE exam and I was thinking about taking the BCADM exam, I would take them in a similar time frame, because both of them have one element in common. That is pathophysiology, well, more than one element, pathophysiology of diabetes, management of diabetes, and also behavior change. Those are, you know, common things that are tested on both exams. But the BCADM takes it up a notch and talks more about management, management of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, other comorbidities, and also looks more at research, mentoring, outcomes. So there is crossover, but I would say the BCADM is more management focused. And so let me get to this question. What's considered advanced management? What are advanced level activities? Well, medication adjustment, MNT, exercise planning, counseling for behavior and psychosocial issues, looking at obtaining optimal metabolic control and monitoring and treating acute and chronic complications, research and mentoring. That's considered more advanced level. So how do you apply for this exam? Well, you need to complete the application 60 days prior to desired testing month. So here's the window to apply for summer. You have to apply by May 1st to take test in June. So you can take it for the month of June, or if you're doing the winter exam, you have to get your application in by November 1st to take the exam in December. Once you receive confirmation that you're eligible, then you need to go to Castle Online Scheduling to register for that. And applications are accepted on a continual basis, so you can apply online. And it does say a certain percentage of candidates, I think it's around 10%, maybe less, will be audited to ensure they comply with eligibility criteria. So just a few, you know, a small percentage of people are audited. And if you are audited, this is what you need to submit: your licensure, diploma, documentation of hours. Now, payment. Not just audited people have to pay, everybody has to pay. This is the hard part, because if you're an AADE member, it's $600. So it's pretty pricey for an exam. I mean, it was almost a deterrent for me to take it this last time, because I'm like, this is a lot of money, and I'm paying out of pocket. But maybe your organization will be willing to sponsor you taking this. If you're not an AADE member, it's $900. Recertification, which you need to do every 5 years, is $500. And if you've lapsed, it's more expensive. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. This is for AADE members. It's $500. And non-AADE members, it's $800. But if you don't let it lapse, whatever you do, because it is a lot more work to get it renewed if you've let it lapsed. Okay, so you might want to know, well, how do I renew this? And as I mentioned earlier, we used to be able to take an exam to renew, but now they're saying, nope, can't take the exam to renew. You have to do activities to renew now. So you have to at least be maintaining those completed minimum 1,000 practice hours over the last 5 years. So you have to be continuing to do diabetes education at advanced level, advanced management level. Plus, you need to have an active license, and then you need to choose a few of these categories to renew your licensure. So you can provide CEs, academic credits, you can show you're doing presentations, publication, or research. You can be a preceptor in a recognized program or do volunteer service. So you can look at the application. You have to choose a few of these and meet a certain criteria to renew, and you have to pay again. And there's the fees. So overview of the BCADM exam, it's 175 multiple choice objective questions. So the CDE is 200 questions. This is 175. So that's a little bit better. You have 3.5 hours to take it, and you have to wait 6 to 8 weeks to get the results. So they're going to mail you their results, and you can retake the test 2 times in a year for a fee. And if you have any questions, I would definitely refer you to the AADE website, or you can call them directly. Is there a practice test available? Lots of you want to know about that. Yeah, there is. The American Association of Diabetes Educators offers a 75-item timed online practice test. So this practice test does reflect current exam comment, multiple choice format, and then you get an overall score plus information about their performance. But you don't get to know which questions you got right and what questions you get wrong. So you can go onto the website for AADE and find out more about that. So I don't offer an exam for this because the writing a good test is really difficult. And this is a higher level exam with more complicated test questions. So I really want to refer you to the test writing experts for this one. I do want to tell you that 25 of the 175 are pre-test questions and are not counted. So in any exam, there's usually 25 or a small percentage of questions that they're just checking out. So the candidate score is based solely on the 150 scored questions. Okay, so here's they call it now the exam blueprint. They kind of changed it up this year, so I would definitely encourage you to download the BCADM guidebook and look through it carefully because they have a lot of good information in there. The candidate handbook, and also the AAD website has some other information that might be helpful to you too. But here's the different areas. We're going to look at assessment and diagnosis, planning and intervention, evaluation and follow-up, and leadership and advanced practice. So that's how they divide up the test, and you can see what percent is assigned to each of these different areas. Let me go over it in a little more detail for you. So assessment and diagnosis, there's 47 questions, and here are the subdomains listed below. And this, I really like this detailed list because you could go through this and just check, rate yourself 1 through 5. How much do I know about therapeutic interviews? How much do I know motivational interviewing, helping people identify goals? What about history, physical exam across a lifespan? Do I feel comfortable working with kids, teenagers, adults, pregnant women with diabetes, and elderly? So they're going to ask questions about all different ages, pathophysiology, self-care, mental health assessment. So do we know about depression screening, anxiety, diabetes distress? How comfortable are we there? Standards of care. Wow, so important. So I'll be going over resources, but certainly being familiar with the ADA and AACE standards of care, and also the practice requirements or the standards of practice through AADE. How good are we at looking at complex data sets and statistics and understanding what that means? And looking at patients' lab values, screening. So you need to know the diagnostic criteria, who should be screened. Can we synthesize a bunch of information? So they're going to give us vignettes about complicated patients, and do we really understand what's happening with this patient and know how to prioritize care? And diagnosis is a part of this. So differential diagnosis and problem list. Diabetes educators, we're not told to do diagnostics. We're told to help patients, look at changing their behavior and looking at lifestyle and setting goals and so forth. But this is much more of a management. It's coming more from a medical perspective, I would say. Planning and intervention is the second category, and there's 48 questions there. So we need to know, again, standards of care are so big for this exam. So you need to know ADA standards of care, ACE standards of care. We need to know about medical nutrition therapy and exercise. There's going to be questions on that, and also pharmacologic intervention. We're going to have to know about surgery, inpatient care. We're going to need to know about technology pump, continuous glucose monitoring, problem solving around that. We need to figure out priority. Priority of care is a big deal on this exam. And then collaboration, evaluation and follow-up. We're definitely going to need to be familiar with the AADE-7. So what are the different categories of education and goal setting we do with patients? Again, look at standards of care comes up, so you know that's a big deal. Outcome and treatment results and helping our patients reach those SMART goals, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and timely. And then do we follow up with people and do goal modification and help them assess where they're at and how to get to the next place? Leadership and professional practice, a big part of this exam. We need to know about the regulatory, accreditation, recognition. So we need to know what does it take to have a recognized program? What is Medicare reimbursed? What are the reimbursement standards? We need to know about quality improvement, national health initiatives, prevention and public health. We need to know about research and outreach. So you can see this is broad. It's covering a lot of information. It's going to take time to assimilate all of this. Maybe you already read the ADA and ACE standards of care every year, so you're ahead of the game. But if you haven't read those yet, it's going to be some of your reading over the next, few months until you take the exam. So what standards are used? I have it here, ADA, ACE. What are the most important study tools, the standards, clinical guidelines? And I do have a book here I recommend, Nurses' Complete Guide to Diabetes Care. I know some of you obviously aren't nurses, but it's really an excellent book to prepare for the exam. And I read through that for the exam, and it really helped me because it talks about all the different related complications of diabetes and the therapeutic intervention and diagnostic criteria. Now, for special populations, because special populations is a part of this exam, we do have online courses, and I have what's called a Level 4 online course, more advanced level, where I have the critical assessment, special populations, and other topics that are relevant to this exam that you can take a look at. What is the best source of information on newer diabetes medications? Wow, it's hard to keep up with all the newest medications. So first, certainly we have our diabetes medication pocket cards, and I sent you in the email a link to those. You can go to our website and download those. But that's one way to know what the latest medications are. But also the Art and Science book, that big book, well, I'll show you a picture of it in a minute, has information on medications. And there's other resources certainly online you could take a look at. What is a passing score? So here's a passing score. They use the following. The minimum score to pass is 350, passing score. So the maximum score is 500. You need to get at least 350 score to pass. That's your passing score. And what's the passing rate? What percent of people actually pass this exam? And currently, it's looking really good. It's 75%. So that's hopeful. And so you could say as you're taking this exam and preparing for it, most people pass this exam. And so you're going to go in feeling confident and prepared. So I want to go over some resources for you. And when I took this exam, believe me, there was really no study tools that I could find out there. I just saw a list, bibliography of stuff to read. So this is what I was talking about earlier on our website, diabetesed.net, our Level 4 online courses. We definitely support preparing for this exam through these online courses. And we offer discounts. The more you buy, the better the fees are. We try to make it really reasonable for you because we want to make it affordable. Here's some clinical books that will help. So this one is the one I was mentioning, The Complete Nurse's Guide to Diabetes Care. Really excellent summary of diabetes and the other complications associated with it. Intensive diabetes management is good, looking at insulin management. And if you're not that familiar with nutrition therapy, this book is a resource. So there's different ones, but of all of these, I'm saying the Nurse's Guide would be the most helpful. And then also the Art and Science book. This is 800 pages of information, and it's listed as one of the references for the exam by the AADE. And certainly, I don't expect people to read it all, but you would kind of read, based on your self-assessment, what areas you need more study on. And then this is, you ask, why does she have this here? It's for the Certified Diabetes Educator exam. I'm going to tell you why I have this book here. It's 400 exam questions. So if you haven't taken an exam for a while, you want some practice, you want to get warmed up, I would get this book, even though I'm taking the BCADM, because it's going to, like I said, there's overlap between the two exams. You need to know your meds, you need to know your standards, you need to know about education and behavior change. That's all part of the BCADM exam, and this book would give you the practice, test-taking practice. The only other exam for the BCADM is the one put out by, NCB or AADE, that has the 75 questions. So I think when you're getting ready to take a test, the more sample tests you can take, the better. And the other thing I want to say is a lot of people preparing for the BCADM exam come to our live course, and it's almost a 3-day course. We're going to do it in Monterey, but we do talk about all of the key content that's in the exam, and we're going to be covering pathophysiology, medical nutrition therapy, medications, and all behavior change. So this course will definitely also help prepare you for the exam. But the thing I really want to point you toward is on our website, diabeteseds.net, resources level 4. I've put these articles on there for you. I made it so easy. Just click the link and the PDF opens up. And so you need to be really familiar with the ADA standards of care. Oops. These are really important. The ADA management of hyperglycemia in type 2 and the ACE algorithm for glycemic control, plus ACE medical guidelines for clinical practice. This on our website. Those articles you just have to read. On our website, on that resource page, we also have this BCADM summary report. And it's a real good summary of kind of the findings that help them prepare the BCADM exam. And then on your resource page, I have these really nice handouts: lipid management, medications for hypertension, management of neuropathy. They're little cheat sheets on lipid, hypertension, and neuropathic management, pharmacologic management, that my wonderful husband, who's a pharmacist, helped me put together. So real nice little quick and dirty reference sheet that you can use to study. Test taking tips. Okay, so I'll just go over these briefly, but I think they're really important. So if you're getting ready to take a test, you want to pay attention to key words such as best, most, primary, usually. These words indicate other options may at times be correct, but given the wording or situation, the test question, you must judge which option is the best. Okay, so they're going to give you a scenario and say, what would be the best approach given this situation? So you might be able to deduce it to two competing answers. Always choose the best answer. There's going to be one that's just a little bit better than the other. I like this next bullet point. Skip difficult questions and come back to them later. The questions are not ordered by difficulty. So, and the content areas are randomly addressed throughout the test. Difficult question, you can mark it on the computer, come back later. When guessing, use a process of elimination, and I really think this is a great tip. Treat each option or each answer as true or false statement. Oh, so you can say to yourself, is that true or is it false? And if it's false, it's out of the mix. Narrow your choices and make an educated guess. Answer every question. There's no penalty for guessing. And don't leave an answer blank. That's really important because even if you don't have any clue of the right answer, you have a 25% chance of getting it right, just randomly choosing one. And this is really important. If reading English is difficult because English is not your primary language, maximize your time by reading and answering all the shorter questions first. After completing the short questions, go back and answer longer questions, which take more time to kind of think through and translate over. So, just some good test taking tips that I really like. Well, speaking of test taking, y'all ready to take some sample test questions? Let's do it. So, these are questions that might, well, they're similar to the types of questions that are on the exam. I'll put it that way. Some of these I wrote myself, and some of these I got from old test guidebooks. Sample question 1. A healthy adolescent with 2-year history of type 1 returns for a quarterly appointment. For the past month, he has experienced abdominal pain and diarrhea after some high-carb meals. An advanced diabetes manager's first intervention is to order what? A. 72-hour fecal fat collection, B. colonoscopy, C. a stool sample, or D. transglutaminase autoantibody test. So I'm going to launch this poll and make your best. Choose the best answer. All right, thanks for voting, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll. And share your results. So we had a real interesting mix of results. 6% of you said 72-hour fecal fat collection. Nobody said do a colonoscopy. I'm sure the patient would appreciate that. 33% of you said let's get a stool sample. And 56% of you said let's do transglutaminase autoantibody test. And 6% of you said not really sure. Okay, so let's just take a look at this question and see if we can get to the root of it. So this patient, he's type 1, he's an adolescent, but he's experiencing abdominal pain and diarrhea. And I think the real important thing is what we hear here is after some high-carb meals. So that should ring a bell. And for 56% of you, it rang a really loud bell for you. And that is people with type 1 diabetes are more likely to get celiac disease. And celiac disease is intolerance of gluten, which makes sense. If this kid's getting abdominal pain and diarrhea after high carb meals, he's, you know, ingesting carbohydrates that contain gluten and causing him this abdominal, these abdominal issues. So that was the clue in the question that told us what would be the right answer. So now we're looking for an answer that says, what is a test to see if somebody has celiac disease? So if you're not familiar with the autoimmune conditions associated with type 1 diabetes, I would just read up on that, because there's a lot of autoimmune conditions associated with type 1 diabetes, including celiac disease, Addison's, thyroid disease. There are some of the more common ones. And we're going to, as advanced diabetes managers, we're going to have to be looking for that in our patients and knowing what symptoms that includes and what tests to order. And then we need to know what the test results mean and what to do after that. And so how do we test for celiac disease? Is it a fecal fat collection? No, it's not. So that would not be the right answer. Colonoscopy? No, we don't use that to test for celiac disease. What about a stool sample? What would that tell us? No, we really send a stool sample to see if there's, you know, an infection or blood or something. That's not going to give us the answer we need. But the right answer is D, transglutaminase autoantibody test. And in a way, just the name of it, the autoantibody test, gives us information because type 1s have a lot of autoimmune disease. So kind of looking for clues in the question and to get to the right answer. So D is the right answer, and 56% of you got that right. So good job, everybody. And if, like I said, you know, if you don't get the answer right, it's okay. Just like me, when I first took this exam, I really realized how much I didn't know. So you want to think about this as an opportunity to expand your knowledge. It's really exciting. Let's read this one together. Miss S is having trouble sleeping and complains of waking up with frequent nightmares. Her insulin dose includes 5 to 8 units of Novolog at breakfast and 12 units of MPH at bedtime. She complains that her before-bed blood sugar is often greater than 300. So she takes extra MPH insulin before going to bed to bring it down. What is your best response? Is it A, instruct patient to decrease the MPH insulin by 2 units to prevent nocturnal hypoglycemia? Is it B, contact provider and request to discontinue MPH and start Lantus instead? Is it C, assess if the patient is having a snack before checking her bedtime blood glucose level? Or is it D, instruct patient how to safely adjust her dinner time Novolog to prevent hyperglycemia at bedtime? What is the best answer? I'm going to launch this poll. All right. We'll take a few more seconds to vote. Okay, I'm going to close this poll. And so let's take a look at this question. And so when you read through, there's going to be a lot of these types of vignettes where you want to really read through it. So Mrs. S is having trouble in sleeping, complains of waking up with frequent nightmares. Okay, let's stop right there. So what is a sign of nightmare? What does that mean? What does it indicate? Well, as it turns out, people who have frequent nightmares or they wake up with headaches often are suffering with nocturnal hypoglycemia. So what's happening is her blood sugar is dipping too low in the middle of the night. And we know why. Because you know why? Let's keep reading. Her insulin dose includes 5 to 8 units of Novolog at breakfast and dinner and 12 units of MPH at bedtime. But since her bedtime blood sugar is often greater than 300, she takes extra MPH before going to bed to bring it down. So this is the crux of the problem. She's increasing her MPH insulin because her nighttime blood sugar is elevated. And she's increasing that MPH and making her blood sugars go down in the middle of the night. And therefore, she's getting nocturnal hypoglycemia and waking up with nightmares. Very common symptom of nocturnal hypo. So given that, now that I kind of shared that with you, what is your best response? And so during this exam, they're going to be drilling down and providing clues that we're going to have to be like little diabetes detectives to figure out what is the right answer. So instructing that patient to decrease the MPH by 2 units to prevent nocturnal, you know, that's not getting to the issue. So A is not the right answer. Is it B, contact a provider? No, to discontinue MPH and start Lantus, that's not going to help it because she doesn't understand about insulin management. When her blood sugar is 300, we don't want to adjust the insulin. We want to fix the problem. So C, most of you chose this one. It says that the patient is having a snack before checking her bedtime blood sugar level. But that is an important part of what we're going to do, but that's not going to help get the situation under control. So of these, D is the best answer. Help the patient to safely adjust her dinnertime Novolog to prevent that high blood sugar at bedtime. Because if she's, you know, even if she had a little snack, her blood sugar should not go to 300 at bedtime. That's telling me that she's under-insulinized at dinnertime. So we're going to have to coach her. You know, that's what we do. We're managers now. So we're moving out of our CDE role and moving more into the management role. We're going to help her make adjustments in that Novolog to get her nighttime to where it needs to be. So, and then, of course, reinforce to her that, you know, basal insulin isn't a sliding scale. You don't adjust it based on what your blood sugar is that night. You know, we adjust it based on the morning blood sugar. So D is the correct answer. And 40% of you got that right, so good job, team. That was a difficult one. Okay, let's look at poll question 3. The American Diabetes Association recommends universal screening for at-risk pregnancies as soon as possible after the confirmation of pregnancy. Confirmation for high risk includes, is it A, glycosuria, obese, more than 25 years of age, strong family history? B, the same risk factors for type 2 as listed in the ADA standards of medical care? Is it C, obese, more than 35, member of high risk ethnic group, strong family history? Or is it D, glycosuria, more than 25 years old, member of high risk ethnic group, strong family history? So we need to know the standards of care throughout the life. So not, you know, not just adults or not just kids. So wherever you work, maybe you work more with peds or more, maybe you work in pregnancy or maybe you work with older people. You got to know the criteria for, you need to know about all age groups as far as standards of care, diagnostics, management. We need to be familiar with across the lifespan. That's really important for this exam. And so for many of us, like in my clinic, I mostly work with older patients. So I would need to spend time, you know, reviewing my peds content and looking at diabetes and pregnancy. But if you work with kids, then you need to look at, you know, more diabetes and pregnancy and older adults. So all of us, wherever we're working, are exposed to different populations. So we want to just expand our knowledge of different throughout the lifespan. And as I mentioned, if you want to gather more information about special populations, we have a course on our online university that would definitely help with that. Several courses, actually. Okay, I'm going to close a poll. Most of you have voted, and I'm going to share your results. We had a lot of different results here. 12% of you chose A, 29% of you chose B, 41% of you chose C, and 18% chose D. And so a lot of different responses here. Let me just take a look at this with you. So it's, now we say that, you know, for women who become pregnant, we need to, when we confirm pregnancy, check to see if their blood sugars are elevated. And when do we do that? And the new guidelines, I do want to say, are B. B is this the correct answer. So if a woman is overweight when she gets pregnant and has any other risk factors for type 2 diabetes, we need to check her blood sugar as soon as pregnancy is confirmed. We used to have all these different criteria for who do we check, but the ADA got rid of that. And they said once a woman becomes pregnant and is confirmed, if she's overweight and has any of the other risk factors for diabetes type 2, we have to check her blood sugars. And that's what the standards say. And some OB practices are just saying, hey, once a woman is pregnant, let's just check her blood sugar. Because we know we don't want that fetus to be exposed to hyperglycemia during the first, you know, 3 months of development. That's a very crucial time. It's when the organs are being developed. So getting those blood sugars to target before pregnancy and during pregnancy are critical. And so, you know, now the criteria is much more inclusive. Anybody at risk for type 2 should be tested as soon as they're confirmed pregnant. Okay. Are they going to ask us questions about hospitalization? Yeah, they are, because they're going to assume we float to the inpatient, or maybe we work in the inpatient and float to the outpatient. We need to know across the continuum of care. Hyperglycemia during hospitalization is associated with poor outcomes due to, is it A, decreased insulin resistance, increased insulin secretion, and increased counter-regulatory hormones? Try and say that three times fast. Is it B, increased free fatty acids, ketones, lactate, inflammatory cytokines? Is it C, increased nitric oxide levels? Or is it D, risk of alkalosis? I'm going to launch the poll. Thanks for voting, everybody. Okay, take a few more seconds to vote. Even if you're not sure, just take a guess. It's totally anonymous. So take a guess and eliminate wrong answers and get to the right answer. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. So, you know, during the exam, you have a little bit over a minute for each question, and I'm keeping the poll open for about 40 seconds, but right now I'm at 53 seconds just to give you a sense of time. So you kind of need to move fast during the exam. I mean, not super fast. You want to take time to read the question and the answers, but you certainly don't want to, you know, dawdle. You just want to keep moving, keep the flow going to get through all the questions. Okay. And so let me share your results. 7% of you chose A, 80% of you chose B, and 13% of you chose D. So it looks like B is the winner, and it actually is the winner, but let me go over why A is wrong. And so when you read answers, you want to, like it said, do true, false to yourself. Is this answer true or false? And during hospitalization, you're in a stress situation, right? When you're infected, when you're, anytime anybody's admitted for the hospital, their stress hormones are on fire. Their body is on fire, actually. So they're in a situation of stress. There's more cortisol. There's more adrenaline. You know, there's more growth hormone being released. So the body is in this huge insulin resistant state. And so right away, even though A does have the word insulin resistance, the first word makes it wrong because it's increased insulin resistance. People in the hospital, you know this, need more insulin when they're sick, when they're infected, when they're stressed. So We know that A is wrong right because of this first word, decreased. It should say increased. So it's false. It is true that when we're under attack, we have more free fatty acids, ketones, lactate, and inflammation happening. So that is true. Let's just go to increase not nitric oxide levels. Well, as you know, that's not a stress response. That would actually lower the blood pressure, and that's not the situation. So that's false. And then some of you chose increased risk of alkalosis. Well, actually, that's also false, because with diabetes and hyperglycemia, we're worried about acidosis, where we don't have enough insulin, so we can't burn glucose for fuel, we burn fat for fuel, and that would be acidosis, not alkalosis. So that's also false. So the right answer is B, inflammation associated with hospitalization. So 80% of you got that right, great job. And if you didn't, it's just, you know, this is kind of a pathophysiology question. It's also looking at hospitalization in diabetes. And if you want a review on that, we definitely have that on our online university, but also on our articles and resource page, we have a whole page dedicated to hospitalization, and it has the guidelines for hospital care in there. You can read through those. Okay, let's take a look at number five. A 40-year-old female patient has a 10-year history of diabetes. She injects 16 units of MPH and 8 units of Lispro before breakfast, 8 units of MPH and 4 units of Lispro before dinner. Here's her blood sugar pattern. Her fasting is 100, pre-lunch 240, pre-dinner 210, and bedtime is 150. So what does the advanced diabetes manager recommend? Should we A, add 2 units of Humalog before breakfast? Should we B, add 4 units of Humalog before dinner? Should we C, add 2 units of Humalog before lunch? Or D, decrease the evening MPH by 2 units? And so you can see this is a little different from the CDE exam, because now we're the manager of the patient. So we're going to take direct action to get this to a better place. All right, thanks for voting, everybody. So you can see, these are the types of questions we're going to have to spend more time on to really think through it. So right now, I'm just going to tell you we're at 52 seconds. That's how much time we're spending on it so far. That's fine, but I'm just giving you like a framework. Okay, thanks you all. Thanks for voting. I really appreciate it. It's risky voting. It's risky choosing an answer because, you know, it's you want to get it right. I understand that. Okay, so I'm going to share the results. 83% of you said, let's add 2 units of Humalog before breakfast. Nobody chose B. 11% said, let's give 2 units of Humalog before lunch. And 6% said D. So let's go over this a little bit. So let's just think about, what are the glucose goals? Well, we know before meals, the glucose goals are 80 to 130. So fasting blood sugar is reaching that at 100, but pre-lunch, it should be 80 to 130, it's 240. It's the highest of the day. So that seems really problematic. Pre-dinner is also above target, should be 80 to 130, it's 210. Bedtime is right on target, it should be less than 180, and it's 150. So where is our biggest issue? Well, it really is pre-lunch. So pre-lunch, going to 240 is above, you know, way above the target. And so how would we remedy that? Well, the best way to remedy that is to give more bolus Humalog before breakfast. If you increase it before breakfast insulin, it's going to bring that pre-lunch down. If we bring the pre-lunch down, guess what? Dinner also comes down. So that's why A is the best answer. because you want to get that lunch down, and to get lunch down, you need to do add 2 units of Humalog before breakfast. Some of you chose C, add 2 units of Humalog before lunch, and you were just, you know, addressing the pre-dinner. But really, we want to get to the best answer, and the best answer would be to get that blood sugar before lunch to target. So I hope that helps. So there's going to be answers that are competing for each other. You always want to choose the best answer. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the next one. Sample question 6. An advanced diabetes manager best facilitates a learning process for adults by A, administering pre and post tests, B, creating an environment in which the learner is an active participant, C, delivering content using standardized slide presentation, or D, insisting on full participation. Let me launch this one. So I can totally tell from your answers that this is like so easy. You guys are like, we know this one. So good job, you guys. And they are going to have questions about adult learners, about behavior change. Now, this is an important part of advanced level 2 because, sure, we're doing medical management, but just like an educator, we need to be familiar with adult learners and the theories behind learning to help our patients take those next steps on. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this poll and share the results. So you guys were on fire with this one. 95% of you chose the right answer. Create an environment in which the learner is an active participant. So anytime you see an answer, active participant, take the adult learner's life experience and values into consideration. Those are the right types of answers. So some of you chose A, and A is, pre and post tests are helpful to evaluate how much knowledge they have accumulated, but it's not really asking about that. It's asking about facilitating the learning process. How do we facilitate the learning process, not how do we evaluate outcomes? So really, when you read through these, really get to the key intent. What are they trying to get to in the question? And then match the answer to that key intent. So you guys did a great job on that one. If you didn't get the right answer, you know, it's okay. You're just going to kind of really focus on reading the question carefully and asking yourself, what are they really trying to get at? Sample question 7. Oh, this is a good one. A 54-year-old obese male patient with type 2 diabetes, A1C 10.3, smokes cigarettes, not exercising. His meds include glipizide, metformin, and levothyroxine. Given his risk status, what 3 classes of meds should he be taking according to the American Diabetes Association? And this is to their standards of care and medical management of hyperglycemia. Is it A, insulin aspirin and ACE inhibitor? Is it B, TZD, ARB, and bolus insulin? Is it C, beta blocker insulin analog and statin? Or is it D, antihypertensive statin, antihypertensive statin, aspirin? Based on what you know here, what 3 classes of meds should he be on? Okay, we're at 30 seconds. All right, take a few more seconds to vote. Okay, thank you, everyone. One more vote. Okay, I'm going to close the poll. Thank you. Okay, let's just take a look at this guy. He's 54 years old. He's obese. He's type 2 diabetes. Okay, so we know he's at risk. His A1C is 10.3. Wow, that's above target. We know the A1C target's 7%. And he's smoking cigarettes, not exercising. So we're pretty worried about his blood vessels and his blood sugar. His meds include glipizide, metformin, and something for thyroid, levothyroxine for his thyroid disease. Given his risk status, which three classes of meds should he be taking? Well, let's just take a look. Given this A1C, he needs to be on insulin. So the American Diabetes Association says when the A1C is 10.3 and he's on glipizide and metformin, insulin is, you got to start insulin because this is glucose toxicity. And we can increase his glipizide and metformin, but it's not going to help at this point. We've got to get this guy on insulin. So now that's our first thing we know for sure. He needs to be on insulin. So we're going to look for the answers that contain insulin. A does, B does, and C does. Okay, let's look at his next situation. He's over the age of 40. And we know that anybody over the age of 40, according to the new standards of care by the American Diabetes Association, should be on a statin. So this gentleman should be on a statin. So here's statin right here. So statin has this answer, and this one also has a statin. So far, this one is looking the best. He should be on insulin, analog, and a statin. But let's see what else he should be on. Does he have hypertension? Well, he could have hypertension, especially since he's smoking cigarettes, right? So he should be on something. Well, you know what? He doesn't. I just want to say something here, and I think I need to adjust my answers because I don't think there's any right answers here, and I totally apologize for this. I was going to change it, but I didn't before this class. But we don't really know if he should be on a hypertensive medication. I would assume he needs to be because of his smoking and his blood sugars, but we never see here that he has hypertension. So, but he should be on an aspirin. So I want to say that this guy should be on an aspirin, on insulin, and a statin, and that would be the right answer. So I really apologize to you all because there's not that answer isn't on here. And so I'm going to change it for the future. But I think it's a good exercise to kind of think through what he should be on. He should be on insulin for his hyperglycemia. He should be on aspirin for his, just because his risk status for having a cardiovascular event. He's a smoker, and he should be on a statin. So those would be the three correct things that he should be on. So that is the right answer, and I promise I'll change it for the next time. So thank you for tolerating that. Writing good questions is difficult, so I was really trying to make it challenging for you to, really flex your brain muscles, and I'll improve. Sample question 8. Current recommendations for screening for type 2 diabetes and prediabetes include in asymptomatic young adults include. Current recommendations for screening for type 2 diabetes and prediabetes in asymptomatic young adults include A. Individuals with an HDL of 52. B. Individuals with a history of Addison's disease. C. Offspring with a parent with type 1 diabetes. Or D. Women with polycystic ovary disease. This is our last one. Okay. Thanks for voting, everybody. And actually, this one does have a correct answer. So I'm not going to put you through that drama again. I apologize. So look at the key intent of the question. Okay, we're at 47 seconds. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share your results. So 6% of you chose B, 6% of you chose C, and 89% of you chose D. So D is the right answer. So let me just kind of look at the key intent of the question with you. We want to find out who's at risk for type 2 diabetes. And some of you chose B and C. So B and C show increased risk for type 1 diabetes, but women with polycystic ovary disease are at much greater risk of getting type 2 diabetes because of increased testosterone levels and insulin resistance. They're at much higher risk of future type 2 diabetes. So 89% of you got that right, which is great. And so if you got this wrong, just kind of reviewing the pathophysiology behind type 1 and type 2 diabetes and the risk for each. I do also want to invite you to join our Level 3 CDE Bootcamp. And again, this says CDE Bootcamp, but it will be helpful for the BCADM exam also. We had a series of 8 webcasts, which are recorded. We just finished it, and it goes over standards of care, pathophysiology, meds, insulin, pattern management. It looked at nutrition therapy, and exercise. It's a real good review of some of the key elements of not only the CDE exam, but also, as I mentioned, there's a lot of overlap of also the BCADM exam. So I want to thank you for joining me, for your patience. And I do know that people who attend webinars like this and seek out more information really tend to be more successful at taking this exam. So I appreciate you taking the time to join us on this Wednesday afternoon. I wish you the best of luck, and we're available as a resource for you. And as I mentioned on our resource page on our website, we have all of those articles listed, and I'll send you a follow-up email with a link to those resources and our online courses and so forth if you want to check those out. So as always, I will stay after the presentation to answer any additional questions, but for right now, I'm going to press the stop recording button and hope to see you at a future webinar or maybe a live webcast. Keep in touch. Let me know how it's going, and thank you so much for joining us. This is Beverly Tomasian, signing off.